You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Special guests and off topics. In this segment, anything goes. You're listening to 3 p.m.
What's good, everyone? Welcome to this episode of 3 p.m. with Heather Hatch.
Hey, yo.
What up?
And my name's DJ.
My name's Charlie.
My name is Sean.
And this is the 3 a.m. podcast. We tell scary stories, make jokes, hang out, have fun.
Yeah.
So
Heather's back.
Yeah.
Dude, by popular demand.
Yeah.
Apparently, like, true crime's a thing and people are into that. No, but we loved having Heather on last time, and so we're super excited to have her on again.
You are the most detail-oriented person we've had on the show, including us.
Oh, dude.
I'm definitely not detail-oriented.
So
you would throw up at, like, my research before I come on, because I'm like, I, like, watch, like, 5 minutes of a YouTube, then I, like, move over to a wiki and just kind of, like, look at it.
And it's, like, not just the research, but the sequencing. Like, you have everything planned out perfectly.
Oh, nice.
The chapters are exactly where they need to be. But
dude, that's exactly when she was sharing with me that original time when I was just on a call with her, I was like, you need to just come on the pod and do this, because like it helps me see it all and understand it really well.
Anyway,
so many people in our DMs being like, dude, Heather did such a great job, so we're happy to have you back.
Dude, you have no idea what that's done to my confidence.
Good.
I just listened to my vocal fry last time and was like, oh no, Heather, after 5 minutes of this, unfortunately, you have to turn it off.
Yeah.
And no. Walk away.
I feel you on that, dude.
Yeah, no, we all hate listening to ourselves.
Yeah. But you were on last time. You teased a couple things. And so tonight we're going to jump into a pretty crazy topic.
Yeah, I think that would be a proper title for it. Yeah, a crazy one.
And one of your favorites, right?
Yeah. Favorites and most, and the thing that keeps me up at night at the same time. So
wild. I'm excited. Real quick, if you're new, welcome. If you're old, welcome back. But if you're new, Heather is Charlie's sister, and we would recommend checking out previous episode with Heather, and we also had another 3 p.m. With Heather's girlfriend Maddie, and that was also a great episode.
And then another bonus episode with Heather and my other little sibling.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Aiden.
Yeah.
Oh, that was a while ago.
Dude, long time ago.
That was back when we were in Kevin's studio, Kevin's bedroom. But yeah, go ahead and check those out if you haven't already. Otherwise, Heather, take it away.
Real quick.
Yeah. Go ahead, Charles. Charles, you take it away.
Heather and I were talking earlier. The concept of fear and scary stories. Not every subject scares people the same way. For instance,
for sure,
some people terrified and obsessed with aliens. That's not my favorite thing. That's like my least favorite thing in the supernatural world.
We all kind of don't jive with like orb videos. But some people,
speak for yourself.
Yeah.
We all three. But some people, it's like
orbs are their life.
This is this is very convincing evidence.
And I do not want to meet those people.
Just kidding. But like,
that's why I don't bring up my aliens around you, Charlie.
No, but like the question of like what truly scares you, right? For Sean, I think I would be right in guessing it's more practical things, right?
Yeah.
And me, it's like demons is kind of what truly scares me, like possession, losing control of yourself, whether that's like actual demonic possession or like mental illness, possession, mirroring possession, right?
Mm-hmm.
DJ, what's like the scariest thing to you?
Anything that isn't understood. Like demons, we can read about them in, I don't know,
there's like holy
scripture.
Yeah.
And I guess you could pray maybe. But like things like when we talk about like glitches in the Matrix.
Ooh,
or like doppelgangers or mimics.
There's like no rules for that.
There's, yeah, what is that?
Yeah.
It's like from the future. You know, so
you must have loved Radio Rental then.
Bro, I've only listened to a couple episodes of Radio Rental,
but shout out Radio Rental.
Yeah, I need Radio to listen
Rental
more.
Is way good.
I know.
DJ, you have to listen. Okay, please. Doppelgangers.
I'll listen to Time your Warps. Recommendation more than these guys. So.
Okay.
And then going along with that, what scares Heather the most? Like, what scares you the most?
Yeah, so I think this, like, definitely has to go with me being a female too. That has like a lot to do with it, but being raped, killed, tortured, mangled.
So like the real life danger.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like, and of course, like I know that not only females experience that fear, but generally a huge population of us females do on a daily basis, where it's like in our daily lives, we are looking at our surroundings, you know, looking over our backs, like while we're walking to our cars, or noticing who's staring at us in a store, just being like, we always have to be like on the lookout for ourselves. So I think that's why there's a huge fascination in true crime amongst females as well. It's almost like an education game.
Yeah.
So if we can learn everything about these crimes, then maybe we will be more prepared, right? It's kind of that anxiety where you're tricking yourself into preparing for something. So I'm anxious, and what am I doing? I'm trying to prepare myself to handle that thing I'm anxious about. Mm-hmm. Right? So that could be a huge factor into the true crime phase and fascination, I guess, especially amongst a lot of females. So but yeah, that would definitely be probably my biggest fear. And ever since I was a little girl, like I was incredibly terrified of getting abducted and falling to harm by a man. So yeah.
So to like put a title on it, like serial killers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Killers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dude, we talked briefly about it, but like the idea of like when you study serial killers, the theme that comes up is like wearing a mask.
Yeah.
And they talk about it. Do you want to dive into that a little bit, Hev?
Yeah, for sure. So like especially advanced killers, as we all know, realize that they need to play the game of society, right? So who's the one of the most famous figures of doing this is Ted Bundy, right? So he figured out early on that he needs to be charming and he needs to be well-spoken. And but every killer has like their own mask that they choose to wear. Not everyone has the same style. So Ted Bundy's arrogant, like very cocky, very narcissistic mask got him by in the time. He was a white male in the, you know, 70s or whatever. And that worked for him. It worked for him on a professional setting and whatever. So yeah, a lot of like sociopathic. And of course, I have absolutely zero stance of speaking about, you know, psychopaths or sociopaths and what they do. It's just something I've noticed, like diving into all these stories. But sociopaths and psychopaths, especially sociopaths, have this need to put on the mask to make sure that they are fitting in. you know, to make sure that they are maneuvering through their environment as best as they can, right? Without necessarily being exposed to what they actually are.
Is that what you mean by playing the game of society? Trying to blend in as, you know, sticking out.
Yeah.
Like a sore thumb.
Like husband, a husband role of having a wife and kids.
Charlie, like, mentioned the BTK killer. Yeah. Where he was a scout leader.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Charles. No. He was a scout leader and, like, super involved, like, in his local congregation and stuff. And, like, a super common thing you hear is, like, I never would have guessed. Right. And that theme is truly terrifying. Is like, this thing could literally be a neighbor or like someone around us. And like, yeah. I don't know. Do you have any idea about stats? Like how many active serial killers they think there are?
I think I've heard something like there's currently like 14 active serial killers like in the US. I'm pretty sure that's an old statistic. Yeah. It's far higher. Like I think it's far higher, honestly.
And the chances of people who might like be entertaining those thoughts at the very least
much higher.
Oh,
you
could
guess there's
so,
probably
so many.
Someone around you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. I think it's actually more, I think more common than what we would like to admit or to recognize, to be completely honest. And I think that a lot of people don't really know what to do if they see early signs, like in their, you know, adolescent children. So, yeah, I think it's far more common. I don't think it's as taboo as, you know, we think it might be. Mm.
I say we jump into it and I say you start wherever you want.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
So
disclaimer.
Oh yeah. Thank you.
And then I'll stop interrupting.
No, you're please interrupt me, please. Okay. My disclaimer is like a listener discretion, strong language because I always have it. Sexual assault, necrophilia, and quite frankly, everything horrific. That is my disclaimer for this beautiful tale we're about to dive into.
And then like talking about this subject, if at any time we sound insensitive or whatever, that's not our intention. And we're not professionals, so we're just like doing our best. Because like these are real life victims. Mm-hmm, right. So we never want to like intentionally or unintentionally misrepresent anyone. But anyway, there we go.
Yeah,
for sure. Thank you, Charlie. Because like I am very sensitive in my heart to being tried to be as thoughtful for these victims and their families as I possibly can. And I may not deliver that or may not seem like it all the time because sometimes I am very like robotic or very cold when I just like kind of spit some facts or spit my opinions. And it's simply because I've been into true crime ever since I was a little girl, you know, like 10 or whatever. And so I'm used to watching, you know, Forensic Files and just hearing these horrific things over and over again. And I think when I repeat it back, sometimes it can kind of come off as a little heartless, but I can absolutely like attest that that is not the case. So I just want to make that clear.
No worries.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. So basically I want to challenge you guys to listen to this podcast. It's one of the best episodes of anything I've ever heard in my entire life. And so on the Exactly Right Network, which is owned by Karen and Georgia from My Favorite Murder, Kate Winkler Dawson has a few podcasts on there. Like, have you guys ever heard of Tenfold More Wicked? Mm-mm. Okay, she's a historian who writes about like historic true crime. She's incredibly intelligent and dives into the history of all these like old-timey murders, which is amazing. She's an author. But anyway, she came out with another podcast called Wicked Words. And so this podcast, I included it in the notes that I sent over to you guys. It has a little screenshot of what it looks like. And in Wicked Words, Kate Winkler Dawson interviews authors and kind of talks about their decisions on writing books and especially around like the true crime arena. So she's interviewing Maureen Callahan, which this author, Maureen Callahan, she's an investigative writer, and she wrote this book about a famous serial killer named Israel Keyes. And so this episode...
Have you guys heard of him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I added it to my list, too.
Is he a cult leader?
No.
Then no.
Oh, shoot. DJ,
do you know anything about him?
I've heard the name, but...
So you know nothing about him, really?
I'll probably recognize it as we go in, but okay. Off the top of my head, no.
Interesting. I just wanted to see where they're at.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So, everyone's pretty much heard the name Israel Keyes, and not a lot of information has been put out about Israel until, I think, in my opinion, Maureen Callahan's book called American Predator. So immediately I download it, the audiobook, listen to it. It's wonderful. So that is going to be my second suggestion to you guys and the listeners, is to first go check out Kate Winkler Dawson's Wicked Words, episode 18, where she interviews Maureen Callahan, and then go download the audiobook. If you want to learn everything about Israel, the audiobook is the way to go. So in this, basically, it's the what I'm going to do right now is kind of what I did last time, where I watched a docuseries and then I just kind of retell in my own words what that docuseries is about. If that's all right. I'm just going to go ahead and steal someone else's work and then retell it to you
guys. Our whole podcast. Perfect.
Okay, cool. So in the episode of Wicked Words, when she's interviewing Maureen Callahan, they just literally dive into a case about a girl named Samantha Koenig. So this is the case that Israel Keyes was eventually caught on. So he was, he made a few mistakes through this case that I'm about to tell you, but this is the case, his most recent case, and it's Samantha Koenig. So Samantha Koenig had just recently turned 18 years old, and she's working in a coffee kiosk in Anchorage, Alaska. And the coffee kiosks in Alaska are actually so common that it's not unusual for young girls to be closing a coffee kiosk at night. It's not an unusual thing. It's so much of the culture that it's actually very common. So she's doing her thing. She's closing up. You can see the surveillance video online on YouTube if you want. I also included a link in the notes if you guys ever want to watch it. But the surveillance video of the coffee shop, you see a hooded figure walk up as Samantha's doing her closing duties. They're talking. He hands her a thermos through the window, which has no screen. And you can tell she's starting to make coffee for this hooded figure. After a few minutes, suddenly you see the muzzle of a gun. And she jumps back, throws her hands up. And then suddenly she just starts running around the kiosk and shutting off all the lights. Right? She's just doing what this hooded figure says, who has a gun pointed at her. A few more minutes goes by. It looks as if in one of the surveillance videos, a car is coming on the backside of this hooded figure. And so this hooded figure ends up leaping through the kiosk window, has Samantha on her knees. Few more minutes goes by, then she takes all the cash out of the register. They go away. He walks her off, and that's the last you see of Samantha, right? Well, come to find out, wrong. You actually end up seeing her later, and we'll get into that. So now there's a missing person, Samantha Koenig, right? So her boyfriend was supposed to pick her up from work. He was running about 10 minutes late. So he reports her missing to her dad and to the police. And the police aren't really taking this seriously at all. And here's why. Samantha Koenig, let's talk about victimology really quick. She had a history with drugs. Her dad was reported to be a Hell's Angel. Let's see what else in victimology. Sorry, you might have to pause for a second.
Totally fine.
Came from a broken home. So the police absolutely did not prioritize this missing person's case. And in fact, it was 12 to 15 hours after she had been abducted that they even looked at the surveillance video for the coffee kiosk. That's how unserious they took this. So she's been missing 12 to 15 hours with one of the most insane serial killers that this country has ever known. So keep that in mind. Okay. Shortly after Samantha's been missing, her boyfriend starts getting text messages come in from Samantha's phone. So he's being sent stuff like, I know what you did, like coming from Samantha's phone. Like, how dare you cheat on me? Like, I need a couple days to run away and get away. So this is now confusing the investigation because and let's go back to it not being a priority of the police. The police thought that Samantha had planned this with the guy. So they're like, she's just a runaway and she's just running away to party for a few days.
Is that after they saw the security?
No, that's a good question. It could very well possibly. Oh, yes, it is, Charles. Yeah, it is.
That's wild.
Yeah.
That's stabbing and twisting the knife.
Yeah.
You know what? Before I go ahead and say like, yes, 100%, I don't want to speak on behalf of the Anchorage Police Department, but
for sure,
there is a good possibility that investigators at the time still thought that Samantha was in on this.
Mm.
Even with the muzzle of a gun being shown in a video, because guns in Alaska aren't that hard to come by. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's what I gather from that. And I'll tell you why I think that in just a second. But anyway, texts are coming in. Now the investigation is even more baffled because they're starting to get text messages from Samantha's phone, right? So she's been missing 12 to 15 hours. They see the coffee kiosk surveillance video. Steve Payne, he's an FBI field, like a FBI agent in the area of Anchorage, Alaska. He reaches out to the Anchorage Police Department offering his services, saying, hey, I can help you out with this abduction. And they're like, nah, we're fine. We got it. And he's like, all right. And then they see the surveillance video and they're like, oh yeah, you know what? We actually could definitely like use your help. You know, just to make sure. Right. So the reason why I bring this up is the book American Predator is solely focused on the investigation of this case. And in my opinion, human ego is a huge reason why a lot of cases are not going to be solved in the future. And those people who had the ego will have to live with that for the rest of their f-ing lives. Mm-hmm. And so there's just a lot of back and forth with ego and kind of drama in this. So bear with me as I sound sarcastic and
salty.
Tell how it is. Yeah. Okay. So I say here, human ego made the Anchorage Police Department say no. But when they saw the footage, they called him back asking for Steve Payne's help, who's the FBI agent. There was a lack of urgency and they didn't even pull footage from the surrounding big box stores until about 2.5 weeks after they saw the surveillance video. Now, what I mean by that is you would think after seeing a video like that at the coffee kiosk, you'd go, okay, there's an IHOP right across the street. Let's go see if we can see anything out of there. There's a Home Depot right next to it. They didn't even do that until 2.5 weeks after the fact. So it's like they're way behind on this investigation for Samantha. Okay.
Is there any way I can play like devil's advocate for the Anchorage police? Have they like...
Please.
Is it one of those cases where it's like a small town who hasn't experienced a lot of this and so maybe they don't know how to handle an investigation, or is that not the case?
I don't think that's the case. Okay. Anchorage is like fairly larger-ish.
At this point. Year is this?
I'm sorry?
Do you know the date or the time? This is like,
yeah, so it's February 2012, February 1st, okay. 2012, yeah, that this abduction occurred on.
Okay.
And also they have a FBI office there in Anchorage.
Okay, so
and
never
so
mind.
I
they
would
can
imagine
handle.
That yeah. It would be like not like small farm town kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's negligence.
And ego.
And ego. Yeah, I think so. And the community there too, obviously I can't speak for it because I've never lived there, but according to Maureen Callahan, she's very like, the people of Anchorage are very like, leave me alone. It's none of your business. My guns, my land, and don't even ask me, you know, about anything. And so that's just kind of like that does have a lot to do with this case, I think, too, because after they pull the surveillance video from the big box stores, they see that Samantha Koenig made multiple attempts to run away from Israel. She was running with her hands zip tied behind her back, and he tackles her. And there's people all around. This is a major avenue of four-lane traffic both ways. They're in the middle of a parking lot in IHOP and Home Depot, and no one, and there's people surrounding them, and no one did anything, which is just, it just has a part to play in in the catastrophic disaster of what ended up happening to Samantha, is the culture of like, don't ask, don't tell kind of thing. So part two is, now we're several weeks later past the abduction of Samantha, and the boyfriend and the dad get a text coming in that just says Connor's Bog Park under photo of missing dog. They get this text, they call over to the FBI field office, but they end up beating investigators there. They look behind the photo of the missing dog, and there's a baggie with a ransom letter and a photo.
We have that photo. Can we pull that up on our end while you talk about it?
Yeah. Please try to, because I want to describe this photo to you really quick.
Okay.
All right. So the photo displays a girl looking at the camera, hair braided, makeup on, with someone holding up a newspaper dated February something, 2012. February what? 12th, right? 2012. And the ransom note requests $50,000 to be deposited into Samantha's account. Oh, by the way, within these 2.5 weeks, not only are texts coming through from Samantha's phone, but her ATM card has been going off, depositing, you know, $500 or $1,000 here or there in the Anchorage area. So they're just missing this guy. They're surveilling all of the ATMs that they possibly can, and they're like barely missing this guy the whole time. Then it goes dead. The ATM card goes dead. They're like, oh crap, you know, like it's almost as if like that's kind of the only way they can like really be on this dude's trail. Then about a week later, after it goes dead, it hits in a small town in New Mexico. Okay. And they're like, movie moment where they're like, what? How suddenly has all this activity been going on in Anchorage and now we're in New Mexico? So investigators call down to New Mexico. They put out a bolo, which is a be on the lookout for the most generic description in the world, which is tall white man. So Sean, watch out.
Can't go to New Mexico.
They have a bolo out in Texas saying, look out for a white dude. Yeah. And they're like, great. You know, we're not going to get anywhere there. So they're kind of tracking this card. Now it's crossed the border into Texas. Okay. After New Mexico, it immediately crosses the border, pulls another $500. They're just trying to track this card as best they can. So FBI from Anchorage gets involved with FBI in Texas, and they're like just totally communicating, saying, you know, we just need you guys to be on the lookout because we see this activity coming on Samantha's card.
So at this point, are authorities thinking like they know for sure like this is a real thing? Like, without a shadow of a doubt.
Like, they don't think
like
anymore.
Like, the ego's not in the way anymore. Or are they still pretty, like...
Are they still blaming the girl?
Ego's not in the way anymore, and I'll tell you why in a little bit.
Okay.
But they are taking it more seriously, for sure. In fact, but at the same time, though, they had a lot of issues. It dives more detail into the book, that they had a lot of issues with the father during this time. Like, not believing that his intentions of finding his daughter were real. So there was a lot of back and forth between law enforcement and actually putting in a ton of effort into this. I would say like FBI was super involved.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay. So the card jumps across, Texas starts talking to Anchorage and are like, let's work together.
Yeah, definitely. So this field agent in Texas, this FBI field agent, she ends up working with one of the Texas Rangers, and she's like, you know what, we might as well, let's figure out the radius of this ATM card. Like, where could it be now, you know, based off of the radius of like where it was last used.
Yeah.
They narrow it down to a little tiny town called Lufkin, Texas. So they head over there and they're like, on a whim, we're just going to see all the hotels and check the registries if there's anyone from Alaska staying in any of these hotels, right?
Dude.
And there's one. So now they have the room number. They've seen the guy. And they have surveillance on this room. So
Meanwhile, there is a hostage somewhere, right? Like, the girl is alive. So they have to find this guy.
Yeah. So yeah, totally, Charlie. Like, tensions are high. Like, they are just watching this guy. They can see that he's standing on the balcony looking down, and you could see him kind of put together that he's being followed. And he immediately turns around and just grabs his bags and just starts walking to his car. He's done with the room. He's done with it. He's walking away, right? So they're on the phone with the Anchorage investigation, and they're like, he's leaving. He's leaving. They know that Highway 59 is about 3.5 minutes away from this hotel. And if he hits that highway, he can fly. And they won't get him back. They probably won't get him back. So they have...
Because if he crosses state lines, right?
Well, they could probably... But he could fly, though, and potentially lose them. It's a matter of, like... This isn't like Los Angeles where you have helicopters and, like, you're never going to lose the police in LA. They'll always be on you. Right? This is like a country highway where you can do like 120 and possibly end up like losing them. Let's say it comes across, let's say you beat the police to a exit and they don't know whether or not to take the exit or to keep going.
Gotcha.
Right. Yeah.
So they're like, if we're going to get them, we need to get them now. So the FBI, or sorry, the Texas Ranger is on the phone with a detective who's tailing him, and he's like, I don't care what you pull him over for, but find something. Just find something to pull him over for. So they're stopped at a light. The light turns green. We're about like 2 minutes away from the highway now. And he goes 3 miles an hour over the speed limit. Oof. He flips on his lights. He's like, this is a reason. Technically he is speeding. Right? He's going 3 miles an hour over. And Israel Keys stops for the cop who's pulling him over. And the cop ended up saying later, like, I cannot believe he stopped. Like, we're so lucky, because there is really no reason why I was pulling him over, except it being like 3 miles an hour over.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. I have benefited from therapy in a way that it's allowed me to feel a lot more lightness in my heart, my head, my emotions. If that's something that you are needing, if that's something that's missing, give therapy a try. Give BetterHelp a try. We want to hook you up by getting it off your chest and it be a little lighter on the wallet. Go ahead and visit betterhelp.com/3am and you can get 10% off your first month. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/3am.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
So anyway, they end up finding the ATM card on his person.
Well, so he just straight calmly pulled over?
Yeah. And he did his best. So it goes more into the book of what actually happened when he's pulled over. And from my memory of the book, there was quite a bit of back and forth before they, because like you can't just search someone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was quite a bit back and forth between Israel and the cops, but they were not going to let him go. I mean, I can't remember exactly how it ended up happening, being a permission to search and seizure, because I can't see Israel doing that. I don't think he gave them permission to. But they ended up finding... So however that went down, go read the book because she'll tell you. But they end up finding Samantha Koenig's ATM card on his person in his wallet. And then they found her cell phone dead in the trunk of his car. So he's being now extradited to Anchorage, back to Anchorage, Alaska, right? To start the interrogations for why do you have the ATM card and why do you have her cell phone?
And where is she?
And where is she?
Yeah.
So this is the most critical part of the investigation, because if Israel Keyes would have kept his mouth shut, they literally would not have anything on him except for those two things, which means he would just be facing fraud charges. So as an investigator, as an FBI agent, you're saying to yourself, then I need to get him to confess.
Yeah.
I need him to think that we know everything and scare him so that he starts talking. So,
and real quick.
Yeah.
Like Heather has already told us, this is one of the craziest serial killers of North America. But like, think to them, they just think it's a guy who might have a girl somewhere who's committing fraud. So they have no idea what they have on their hands at this point. Yeah. And like Heather said, they have to get him to confess.
And that's a good point, Charles. That's exactly why he gets extradited back to Anchorage, because they tried to interrogate him a little bit in Texas and they realized that this is not a normal guy. He is not rattled in the least. He's acting as if we pulled him over for jaywalking when he has a missing girl's ATM card and cell phone in his trunk. Mm-hmm. So they're like, yeah, you know what? On second thought, like original Anchorage FBI, why don't you take this one? Because like he is not normal. So yeah, that's a good point, Charles. So now here's where human ego comes most into play. The FBI can lie to him and they could say like, we know this and we know that, and scare him. Like the FBI can come in and say, oh, we have your fingerprints in a house. When, like, they absolutely don't. Mm-hmm. But who cannot lie is a prosecutor. So the federal prosecutor walks in and says, this is my case now. Because it's now so, like, high profile. Okay. And they're like, the FBI's like, no. That's going to be a huge mistake. And let me tell you why. You won't get him to crack. You can't lie to him. And we need to find Samantha. So... please have us do the investigation. And he's like, nope, career making case. It's my case. And they're like, fuck. Yeah. So all of that politics is going on simultaneously while trying to balance getting this information, because we need to find Samantha. Okay.
I've never heard a story where the politics in the background of everything is like just as,
dramatic
as the actual kidnapping, you know?
Dude, I feel like it happens a ton.
Yeah, it makes sense, but
it sucks. It sucks so much.
I'm frustrated right now.
Definitely. So, okay. So, basically what ends up happening is they end up telling Israel, we'll cut a deal. If you confess to Samantha, we'll take the death penalty off the table. And at first, Israel's down for this deal. He's like, fine. As, you know, because keep in mind, Israel has a 10-year-old daughter at this point and a girlfriend. So he's like, yeah, all right, take the death penalty off the table and I'll confess to Samantha. Because, and also, Israel was requesting to speak to the FBI because he hated that lead prosecutor. So he was like, I'm not going to talk to you. I'm going to talk to them. So that ended up actually working in the favor of the investigation because they were able to convince Israel that he was going to be convicted for Samantha's death either way. And so if Israel's ego, his own ego, didn't get involved there, then they probably wouldn't have gotten anything for Israel. So here's what ends up happening. This is Israel's account of what happened that night. Okay. He confesses to Samantha's death. He took her out. So after walking her away from the kiosk, he goes into a lot of detail of them kind of driving around. And this is more in the book, not in the episode. But they drive around, smoke cigars, and they're just kind of hanging out, right? Where he actually starts end up liking Samantha, according to him. He gets her into his shed at about 1 a.m. Keep in mind that he has to get up in about 5 hours and wake up his daughter, take a cab to an airport, and go board a cruise out of New Orleans. He has 5 hours. His timeline is so tight that the FBI literally was not believing a word he was saying. So he takes her out into the shed. He has the radio on loud. He's waiting for his girlfriend to fall asleep. This is what ends up happening. He realizes that he doesn't have Sam's ATM card, so he has to go back to the kiosk. Goes back to the kiosk, breaks in, yes, goes and gets that's not where the bank card was. It was her phone at the kiosk. So he has to go back to the kiosk, break in, get her phone, come back. Then he's like, where's your ATM card? And this is all happening while Samantha's tied up in his shed. And she's like, oh, my boyfriend and I share a bank card and it's in his truck. And he's like, great, what's the address? Runs to the boyfriend's house. The boyfriend is there after not picking up Samantha and dealing with this whole missing persons bit. The truck is parked on the driveway and Israel breaks into the truck and the boyfriend comes out while he's breaking into the truck, grabs the bank card, and then the boyfriend and him just kind of stare at each other. And the boyfriend, Israel didn't know whether or not the boyfriend was going to do anything. And the boyfriend ends up turning around to go report it, right? So he ends up not charging Israel. Israel books it, goes to the bank, realizes he doesn't have the PIN. So he goes back to the shed, goes and talks to Samantha, writes the PIN number on the back of the card. I mean, now he's down to hours before he has to leave, right? So the timeline is just getting tighter and tighter, and he's facing all of these difficulties throughout his night that he's messing up on, quite frankly. He's sloppy about. So waiting for his girlfriend to go to bed, checking on his daughter, waiting for her to fall asleep. Now they're running out of time, so he rapes Samantha and then he strangles her. And then he was a little weird about this in all the FBI interviews, but there definitely was some necrophilia involved with Samantha, unfortunately.
Does he deny it?
He just gets weird about it. So it's like he doesn't want to answer blatantly. Mm-hmm. He just gets weird about it. So, and he only wants to talk to this certain female investigator about it. It's all bad. So you can hear a lot of that in the book for sure about
conversation. That's enough for me.
Yeah. I don't want to dive into it any more than that. But and then he leaves her in the shed and he and his daughter only take a cab to the Anchorage airport, fly on out to New Orleans and hop on a cruise for about about 12 days. And the investigators were like, well, what did you do with Samantha's body? Now, keep in mind, guys, this is the night of the abduction. Mm-hmm. So the whole ransom photo, they're just learning right now. Wait a minute. The ransom photo wasn't even given to us until about 12 days after the abduction. Like, how the hell does that work?
Had a newspaper
date. Yeah.
Think in your mind in the photo. Just think of the photo, like what it looked like before Heather continues.
Looked very alive.
Right. So this is where what's baffling investigators. So they're like, wait a minute. Back up. Like, what did you do with Samantha? And he's like, well, I just left her in the shed. It was like 20 degrees in Anchorage. And I knew she'd be okay. I knew that my girlfriend wouldn't go check on her. Like, she's not allowed to go into my space or, you know, look on my things or whatever. And so when he gets back from the vacation, he took some makeup. Some of it was Samantha's. Some of it was his own girlfriend's. Made up Samantha's face, braided her hair. She's dead. She's frozen. And then he takes some fishing wire and needle and he sews her eyes open and then poses her and then takes a multitude of photos, actually, and then writes the ransom and does the whole bit with the boyfriend and the dad. And then he prepares the body for dumping, like right after he takes the photos, he starts cutting her up and making it easy for a dumping. So he ends up giving investigators, like, while he's confessing to this, he gives investigators exact coordinates to one of the deepest parts of the deepest lakes about 40 miles away. And they're like, oh no, she's been dumped in it, like in a fishing hole. Because in Alaska, as I'm sure you guys know, they do a lot of like ice fishing where mm-hmm. you can just like create your tent around you, right? And then be in a hut for days on end fishing, mm-hmm. like by yourself out on the ice. So like, what a perfect quote unquote way to get rid of a body. You're just completely concealed. You can have whatever you want in those tubs that you bring with you and you are alone in a tent. And so that's what he did to get rid of Samantha's body. So he ends up giving the exact coordinates to the investigators. It's this whole thing in the book. It's this like special dive team from like down in LA. They have to come up. It's a whole thing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of politics in that too. They end up recovering Samantha's body though, thankfully. So they did confirm that it was her.
Wow.
Now this is kind of where it gets crazy too, because now they're like, what the actual you know, like, we wanted you to admit to Samantha's death, and you were, like, on another level of thought-out, meticulous, like, you're just on another level of
like, this is not your first.
This is not your first, yeah. This is absolutely not your first kill. This is not your first time doing this. There's no way in hell. And so now they're in this weird dance of, we have to let him know that we know about more, but we have no names, we have no bodies, we have no details, but we have to let him know so that he talks about it, right? Yeah. So now they're really in a tough place. And after he confesses to Sam, he kind of gets in Israel, kind of gets into these fights with his defense attorney. And he's like, you know what? I changed my mind. I want the death penalty. I don't want to go through with this. And I want it fast. He's like, I'm not going to be on death row for years on end. Like, you're going to give me the death penalty within a year.
What?
Like, I want to be dead with, I want this all to be over. I don't want my daughter. He has all these conditions. He's like, I don't want my daughter to know anything about me. So no media, no stories about me whatsoever. He's like the prince of fucking serial killers.
Do they kind of have to give him what he wants because they need information?
That's where it gets tough. Because the FBI could say, yeah, we could do that for you. Because that would be a lie. But the prosecutor can't promise that.
Right.
So they're like, they're just in a really tough place with that.
Hmm.
So he wants the death penalty. He wants it fast. He goes, look, I'll give you two bodies and a name if you give me the death penalty. Like, I want it back. And they're like, okay, cool. We'll do that. So he like pulls up an iPad and he gives them exact coordinates for this barn house in Vermont. And it's the Couriers, Bill and Lorraine Courier. I'm not going to dive into this case. It's horrific. It's absolutely horrific. And when I, like, Charlie, you know me, I listen to a lot of
I'm terrified stuff, that you don't like it.
And I almost threw up, like, listening to the book and the details of what the poor, you know, what Samantha and the Couriers went through. So he kind of goes into a lot of detail about the Couriers, and they're taking him pretty seriously because they go out and they check, cross-check all of these facts. And what he's saying is pretty spot on. Unfortunately, they couldn't recover the bodies of the Couriers because he was so good at getting rid of bodies. So
at this point, they realize they have like a full-blown monster.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah. Okay. So Israel is now realizing after the Couriers, he's like, oh my gosh, they know nothing. And he's like, now I have all of the power because they need me.
He's literally playing them.
Yeah.
So hard.
So he gets the freaking New York Times sent to his cell every day. He has internet access. He tried to commit suicide one time and they had to put him in the psych ward. They bring him back and they zhuzh up his freaking cell. They always give him a cigar and a Snickers every interview, like every time he wants to talk. You know, it's just like he just goes into this ego trip, Israel does, because he's like, I have everything that you need kind of thing. And you obviously want to know about me kind of attitude. And eventually it all comes to an end. He ends up killing himself in his cell and leaves behind so many unanswered questions and so many open cases. Like, literally, it's the most disappointing thing, because if one freaking federal prosecutor I need to be careful, but allegedly. Truly though, like, if egos weren't involved and if politics weren't involved, like, I'm sure that there could have at least been an attempt to close some of these cases. Mm-hmm. And now, well, I don't see any way that can happen. So that's kind of a basic rundown of the story of what got Israel caught, which was really interesting, which is a bank card pinging, which you would think someone so organized, meticulous, would and have thoughtful. Thought of that,
yeah.
Right. Come to find out in the book, he was going through a lot of like personal stuff at the time. And I think he just tripped.
He was, you know, like berserking.
It was just like a trip. So thankfully he tripped, right?
Right.
But it's just interesting that like he claimed, I think he was embarrassed, honestly, because at first he claimed that he didn't know that bank cards could be tracked. And everyone was like, bullshit.
2012.
So he tried that one because he was embarrassed. So. Okay. I do want to tell you guys a little bit about what happens for Israel, according to his words, when he was like feeling the urge to kill. And this is kind of going back into what is so incredibly scary, Charles. The reason why I picked Israel for being one of the scariest is because he doesn't seem to have an MO, which is he doesn't seem to have a preference in victimology. Whereas like Ted Bundy, brunette girls with hair split down the middle, tall, educated, co-eds, right? Mm-hmm. That was his type. And so if you were tall, brunette, with your hair parted down the middle, you would probably cut your hair short and dye it blonde in order to feel safer.
Yeah. Am I right as well? Like, it is insanely rare that a serial killer kills like outside of their race, or, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's usually within race and they don't cross race. And it's like usually age specific. Like, there's so many things. It's so specific.
Yeah.
Israel had like
no
he ain't got rules. No type. Yeah. He ain't got no type.
Male, female, old, young, weak, disabled, fully strength, didn't matter. He was an opportunist killer. It was literally about the hunt more than the hunted. And that's what makes it so incredibly terrifying, because as a female, it's scary being a target. But what Israel's kind of brings to the world of true crime is now you guys get to be scared too.
It's just like everyone's on the same
playing field.
Yeah.
And like there's this one story, for example, where Israel was on the hunt one night and he was sitting in a parking lot of an apartment complex, and he sees this kind of like, you know, fit guy getting out of his car and it's pouring down rain. So this guy like puts a newspaper over his head and he's kind of running to his door, and Israel's on his tail. He's like, he's mine tonight. Like, and he's like, if that guy was 5 seconds slower, he would have been mine. In fact, I'm pretty sure that was the same night as the couriers, or the same time period. Oh, he had to move on to a different target.
So like the guy got inside and shut the door and Israel was like, damn. But like that's how, so kind of explain his process. He would fly into random places.
Like all that shit.
Yep.
Can you explain all that? Yeah.
Yes. When he felt the urge to kill, he would fly out of Anchorage, where he was living with his girlfriend and his 10-year-old daughter, fly into a major hub like Chicago or whatever, New York. He'd then rent a car and he would go on the hunt, which is his words. So he started unearthing all of these kill caches or kill kits, right?
So real quick, can I tell a little bit? Israel created kill kits that he hid all around the U.S. And Canada, maybe. I don't know. Who knows? To this day, people are coming across him. So this hiker was like hiking, saw like a little cave, went up to it, sees the top of a bucket and opens it up, and there's like gloves, rope, gun, knife, duct tape, something.
Damn.
So Israel's kill kits are all around the U.S. So he would literally just fly out to bury these and like keep track of where they all were. So yeah, he's landed. He's got a car. He goes, grabs his kill kit, and then he goes on the hunt.
Exactly. Yep. And he would unearth these kill caches or kill kits. Like Charlie explained, of what they contained, guns, ammo, zip ties, Drano to accelerate human decomposition, wads of cash. He ended up getting all of this cash from bank robberies around the United States. He was a huge bank robber, and he would rob banks, to come down from the high of a kill. Right. Well, so like for fun after.
And then another side.
He just needed that feeling again. Go ahead, Charles.
Sorry. Another side note. Radio Rental recently covered a story of a lady.
That's where I heard his name.
So Radio Rental just covered a story of a lady. Go listen to Radio Rental. Go listen to the story. It's way better hearing it from her. But the gist is she's driving. She gets turned around. She's in a one-way road and she flips her car around and there's a guy in a truck or like a car. And she gets really close to him and they make eye contact and the guy is wearing a wig. He's wearing a fake mustache and they make eye contact. And she said just like pure evil feeling. And she took off. Later, she found out she had ran face to face into Israel Keyes after he robbed a bank. And like that was.
Yeah, you can see the photo of him and his fake mustache that she's referring to online if you Google his name. So, wads of cash would be in these buckets, and all the other items that were kind of mentioned. So he would have his, now this, what this shows is incredible thought into the process, right? I mean, he's flying into a major hub. He drives for hours and hours on end into somewhere different. And not only that, he became an expert at getting rid of bodies and always crossing state lines to get rid of bodies too. That makes it federal. That stumps a lot of local investigators not going further out of their jurisdiction for a missing persons case. So what it ends up doing is leaving a ton of missing persons cases open and not being solved because the investigation's just not going further. A, they don't have a body, and B, the body is cross lines that they don't know of, right? So they're like, we can't go any further than this.
Right.
So you end up finding out through a lot of these interviews with Keyes that he had kind of a master plan going on, but he would do these kills to in the meantime of this master plan, which was he had kind of two major thoughts to this master plan. One was that he was going to travel around the United States as a contractor or handyman and capitalize on the frequency of natural disasters. So Katrina's, hurricanes, tornadoes, because who's ever going to wonder if the woman or man going missing was from a serial killer or from the natural disaster? Mm-hmm. So he's going to capitalize on that opportunity to kind of feed his compulsion. That was a part of his master plan. Another part was that he was planning on setting fire to a string of churches across the United States. So killing these victims, staging them in very like shocking and taboo poses within the church, and then ending up setting the churches on fire. In order to create national fear and national panic. So he wanted panic on a major scale, not just these individual as well. So
it's wild.
That definitely shows like a tremendous amount of anger, you know, in someone. So let's kind of like touch really quickly on the background of Israel, because before this podcast episode came out, I hadn't heard much about the background of Israel Keyes. And to be completely honest, like, the FBI is not super forthcoming about a lot of details, but we do know some. So Keyes described his parents as cultists. So his words, not the words of Maureen Callahan or you know, anyone else. He describes them as cultists. So we end up finding out that he is one of 10 children. Okay. He and his older sister, so he's number two. So his older sister is named America. They were born in Utah and grew up in Utah until about the age of five for Israel. And his parents were Mormon, but they were super, super odd. So they're cultists. They were known as nomads. They were hopping around from cult to cult, ended up getting into the Mormon church. They had their two kids, but never let the kids go outside. The kids were born in the house. They didn't have social security numbers. They didn't go to school. And so they were like, eek.
They were homeschooled?
All these Mormons are getting really curious about our babies. We need to get out. So, because they didn't want CPS to be called on them. They leave the Mormon church. They head out to Colville, Washington, which is a mountain town. Mm-hmm. And they literally live in the woods. So I think his name's John, who's the dad. John ends up saying, you know what, I'm going to build a cabin, but it takes him years. The family they're literally living in a tent in the freezing cold winters of Washington. No heating, no electricity, no plumbing. And even when the cabin's built, no heating, you know, just fire, no electricity, no plumbing. So Israel has to learn how to hunt from a very early age. He's the oldest boy. And so from a very early age, he is illegally hunting animals so that his family can eat. Mm-hmm. So just a tough start. A little bit of a tough start for Israel as far as like, it's not very traditional, I guess you could say, growing up in a cabin, having to hunt so your family can eat, and like no school or anything like that. Okay, so they join a white supremacy group called the ARC. Dope. This is where... Dope.
Just great moves.
This is where Israel becomes friends with Chevy and Shane Kehoe. Chevy and Shane Kehoe, which those names sound familiar.
Yes.
Okay.
The Kehoes. They end up,
yeah, the Kehoe brothers. They end up becoming the top 10 FBI most wanted on the top 10 FBI most wanted list. One of the brothers ended up having ties to Timothy McVeigh, who was the Oklahoma City Bombers.
Dude.
And okay, so it's just this whole little destructive clan. Interesting side note. Can I interesting side note for Charlie really quick if he wants to go into a rabbit hole? Okay, Charlie.
Yep.
When Israel Keyes was extradited from Texas to Anchorage, they had a mysterious stop in Oklahoma City. I still don't know what it's about, but why did they mysteriously stop in Oklahoma City when he's friends with Chevy and Shane Kehoe, who has ties to the Oklahoma City bomb? Don't know.
Dude, MK Ultra.
Just look into it.
Maybe.
Look into it for me. But I just found that interesting. Anyway, so he's around 13 or 14 when he becomes friends with the Kehoe brothers. Now, okay, at an early age, Keyes is starting to grow his interest in breaking and entering. From anywhere from like stealing guns to literally just moving furniture and hiding and watching their reactions when people come home. Like, he's just developing his interests in terror. So he's torturing, classic serial killer. He knows from a very early age that he is different and that he's a killer. So here's what he ends up doing to fill his time. He tortures animals. He sets fires. He breaks into people's homes, steals their possessions, moves their furniture. He trains himself for hours on end in the middle of the woods to stay still and to not make a sound. And he's starting to realize, I am really good at hunting animals. I can probably hunt people too. So he starts realizing this from a really early age. Another note for Charlie. His dad ends up dying from somewhat mysterious circumstances, so you might want to look into that later.
Bruh. He killed him.
We don't have time to go into it. It's just so much. Like, this guy is so, we can do 40 different parts on this guy. There's so much information. Okay. So then we're still in the background of Israel and his upbringing and whatnot. So, just an interesting little tidbit about his background, too. He had one sister, because he was one out of 10 kids. He had one sister who used to do, like, the same kind of stuff he liked, being, like, torturing animals and stuff. And when the FBI asked him, like, what happened? Why didn't you, like, proceed or whatever? He said, because she couldn't keep her mouth shut. So he learned from, like, a really early age that he needed to wear this mask. He needed a wife and daughter. He needed to not talk. He needed to blend in. So he became a contractor, just worked on homes, and was an opportunist killer. And he did it for about, well, they think his first kill was when he was pretty young, up in Colville, Washington. And then he did it all the way up to when he got caught with Samantha. So the FBI, if you look up Israel Keyes online, it says he's responsible for 11 murders. It's, in my opinion, the most bullshit number ever. And it's literally because in all of Keyes' interviews, he kept saying less than a dozen. Because he was just playing with the FBI the whole time. So what an odd phrase, less than a dozen. So the FBI decided on 11.
11. Yeah.
So, but there's no way. I mean, this guy's, he was so advanced from an early age in terms of killing and being in a mind state to kill, where he was like learning detail and learning how to adjust. I highly, highly, highly doubt that it is 11.
Is there any predictions out there maybe from professionals or you know what I'm saying?
Definitely. So in the book American Predator, Maureen Callahan goes into a lot of possible cases, and it's exciting. Like, names you'll freaking recognize. So I highly recommend going into it. Like, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Boca Killer, but he's probably the Boca Killer. So yeah, like, read the book or listen to Kate Winkler Dawson's episode, because they do kind of dive into a little bit more of possible cases that might be, you know, quote unquote, his responsibility.
But can they put a number to him? Like a ballpark? Do they think it's like 50?
I'm not sure.
They have no idea.
Well, I'm not sure. Okay. I don't know. Maybe I missed that when I was listening to the audiobook. For some reason, I'm not remembering number.
How old was this dude when he died?
I think he must have been 30. Gosh, she said it on the episode when I re-listened to it today.
Early 30s?
Yeah.
Prime age, boys.
What are you saying?
Yeah. We're all in our early
30s. I want to just put this out there to
Sean's getting real uncomfortable over there.
Why?
In an effort to put it out there, prove that I'm not a serial killer. Because there were a lot of similarities.
Saw you getting fidgety over there. Living in the woods in Washington. Living in the woods
in Washington, moving around all the time.
Homeschool, ton of family.
I just bought a random ticket to somewhere tonight. I just, before we started recording tonight, I said to Charles I was good at putting on a mask for people. That's super incriminating.
You're doing a good job at defending yourself.
This is what I'm saying is, by putting it all out there for everyone to see, they're going to be like, oh, he's not a serial killer because he's being honest.
Or is that your mask?
And then, like, literally before you said it, I was like, you know, a good idea would be like natural disasters, going around to those and like taking care of people in the middle of those. I'm not a serial killer. Okay.
Here's the thing. We've all taken the test.
What test?
Once you've taken it, you can't take it again.
Yeah.
Like, it was obviously like never mind.
Sean.
Anyway.
You know what that proves to me, though, for real?
Yeah. What?
You should probably go into the FBI and become a criminal profiler.
I probably should.
And they're just like, Sean, what would you do in this situation? Sean's like, oh, I would stab them in the eye and hide them in the ceiling. And they're like, there they are.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
It's like a Dexter situation.
It's all about outsmarting them. And
dude, you should. Like, you should consider it.
Mine's like Sean's, like where you have the mind for it, but you're not a killer. Like, I totally get that, right?
If there were one or two things that went differently, I might have been like one or two things that went right for me that turned out to not make me a serial killer.
Right. Yeah. And that's, I face that a lot, Sean, within myself. Like, why am I so interested in this? Like, what the F is wrong with me? Or like, how can I catch those details really early on? Or like, how can I watch this mystery and kind of know the outcome already? Because I'm like in the mind of the killer. Mm-hmm. I face that a lot too, but it's all about outsmarting them. There's nothing wrong with understanding. There's everything wrong with acting upon.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
You know, those things. So, or like inflicting harm upon another human being. Like, obviously that is unforgivable.
Oh, Sean's a teddy bear. We're good.
Yeah.
Not a teddy bear either, but not a serial killer.
Your mind could be useful. Like, you know, in terms of like a criminal profiler stance.
I'm going to look into that for real. I'm going
to. Dude, do it. You got it. They do recruit a lot out of like BYU, like for the CIA, or like, because Mormons are very honest and trustworthy.
Not to blanket any group of people, but.
Yeah. Just saying.
Okay. Well, I'm going to for real look into it, but I wanted to put it out there that I'm not a serial killer.
Well, thank you, Sean. You've convinced me.
Is there anything out there that speaks on Israel being caught in Texas, pulled over?
Yeah, so I think there's actually a YouTube video you can watch of it.
Like, he knew. He's like, this is it. This is the end of my career.
Yeah, so like his mom speaks to that a little bit. When she watched the video of him getting arrested in Texas, she was like, I could see it in Israel's face that he knew it was the end.
Wow.
Like it was the end of his life, for
and,
sure.
And where are, where's his family, his girlfriend, his daughter?
Right, okay, so his daughter must be close to like 18, 19. There were no signs of like her being sexually abused or anything, which is like pretty crazy and astronomical. A lot of people in their lives said that there was a dramatic change in Israel when his daughter was born. And even the most like cynical FBI agents who spent the most time with Israel genuinely believed that he loved his daughter, which is really interesting. That's like one of the most bizarre things about Israel's case.
It sounds so like I'm schizophrenia not sure. Or like bipolar almost. Like you can shut off a part of you. Maybe not shut off, but like there's just multiple personalities where.
Yeah, compartmentalizing or yeah, definitely, for sure. And probably a master at that, but, or not a master rather, but very, very good at doing that. But as far as I know, I don't know much about his girlfriend or his daughter, but I do know that his mom and some of his sisters are still like cultists. Mm-hmm. And he was actually visiting family while he was in Texas. And so he was like behaving super weird around his family, his mom and his sisters. One of his sisters was getting married down there, and he like ended up disappearing for like a crazy amount of time while he was down there before he ends up getting caught. It's this whole thing in the book. So maybe like later in the future after I re-listen to the book, DJ, I'll text you and just be like, hey, this is a little more detail of like what his sisters and his mom are up to and like what happened that night or that week while he was in Texas. But as far as listeners go, definitely go download the book or go buy it. Mm-hmm. And read it or listen to it. It's super educational and very factual. So
do you have anything to like conclude or surmise your thoughts or, I don't know, wrap up like this episode?
I've been thinking about that. Like, how do I say, okay, thanks for letting me like kind of ruin your night? But I think what's important is, although it is a major fear, like this kind of killer, this killer that we've never seen before, who doesn't have, you know, a pattern, a motive, it's completely random. It's weird how like learning about Israel has literally changed my life. I look out my window at night a different way. And I think it's just good for people to keep in mind that the more we educate ourselves and the more that like the good brains put their heads together, the more we can figure out like how to hedge against these killers, because I don't think evil will ever die, to be completely honest with you. I think it'll always be a battle of, you know, balance in the world. And so male and female, to be open to learning about this stuff, not only to honor the victims and like what they went through, because it's almost like a Hunger Games sacrifice where it's like, you know, you've added to this story, to this information. If Samantha Koenig didn't go through and endure the hell that she endured that night, I really wouldn't be learning that there is this type of human out there for me to watch out for.
Israel very well could still be at large, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They asked Israel, who's your favorite serial killer? And he said the one you haven't caught yet. Meaning there's one right after me who's much better, much faster, and will do it much better than I did. So I guess it's just to say, like, always be on the lookout for one another, too, because, I just feel bad. Like, Samantha did try her hardest to not be put into that truck. So like, you know, look out for yourself, look out for others, put your minds together, like, and like figure out a way to be more protected against these kind of offenders. Yeah, it's just incredibly tragic, but I'm grateful for like the sacrifice so that I can learn more about this so that I can hedge against it myself and try and keep like myself or, you know, the loved ones around me protected more, you know, that there are people like that out there. So I don't know really how to conclude it other than that, just for listeners to, it's okay if you're into this stuff, you know, and whatever your reasons, like it's okay. And you're not weird if you figure out a murder mystery because you're in the head of the killer, you know, it's actually incredibly like skillful. As long as, of course, certain boundaries aren't crossed or like certain lines aren't crossed, of course. Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for having me on, guys. Like, I hope I didn't bore you with a very tragic case.
No, no. It's good to hear these two because I think they bring us back to reality. They kind of ground us and remind us of like, because we so often can tell scary stories and we can talk about these things and they're fun and lighthearted. And sometimes people die in them and it's like you kind of are emotionally disconnected from that. But like to hear a true story of, you know, one girl's like last moments and then like hear the effects of that. And like, I don't know, it just like reminds you a little bit of like the reality of things. I don't know if that made sense, but
yeah,
totally.
Like
totally.
This shit can be real too. Not just spooky stories around a fire. So remember that balance and remember your boundaries and things like that.
For sure.
But also, like you said, data mine, recognize patterns and you know, if this helps one person avoid any type of predator, then like you've brought goodness to the world. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the case of Israel Keyes, he was one man and caused so much destruction and forced teams of investigators and authorities and just resources and money to go into everything that he caused. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side, I really think one person can make a difference just by educating themselves, being aware, looking out for each other. So
definitely.
I actually kind of like, as you're talking about that, I want to like add that almost to the sign off is like, look out for each other. Because we talk about like, you know, protect yourself and stuff like that. But like
the ripple effects won't show like Israel Keyes. Mm. And that's like the good thing. You know,
like, so like you might help one person and but you will never know if that avoided Israel.
Right. Yeah.
I know what you're saying.
Unfortunately, you know,
that's good.
Yeah. It's a good thing. But yeah, it's easy to maybe get into the spot where you're like, I'm not doing anything or this is useless.
This is my responsibility. Yeah.
But because there are no effects, that's a good thing. Hmm. I don't know. That's how I'm taking it. But anyway.
Anything from you, Shawnee?
Well, there was one thing that I thought was kind of, this stood out to me when you were talking about how criminals have an MO and like they go after a certain kind of people. And like another thought I had was, well, more and more people are more like Israel Keyes now. And those are the people that they haven't caught yet because they're, statistically there's an MO.
And they recognize that.
I don't think there's an MO probably for more serial killers now.
Mm. Oh, absolutely agree.
With that, like,
Sean. And evolution. That's like, it's interesting because I'm sure you've had this thought, if I were to guess, I'm sure you've had this thought like earlier than right now, right?
100%.
Yeah.
I think we all did. Like, you hear about Ted and you're like, oh, I would just switch up my kill.
Mm-hmm, for sure. So absolutely 100% agree. I think there's going to be a whole, you know, group, a whole different breed, should we say. And that comes with the times too. Like, you know, there's a lot of similarities within time periods, like types of killers and now they can track fingerprints. So we got to change up our, you know, as technology advances, so the human brain has to advance in order to keep up with how to combat that technology. So you know, never leaving a scrap of DNA is almost literally impossible. So now it's a matter of not getting into the system at all. Anyway, it's a whole thing, right? Where it's like,
it's just always
we're going to see a whole different breed and soon, I'm sure.
But at the same time, like, if I'm not wrong, I feel like murder rates are down, right? Because it is so easy to catch, right? Am I wrong? Okay.
I wouldn't necessarily say murder rates are down. There's always like high murder. I would say advancements in technology definitely has contributed to the number of caught killers.
Yeah. But
you know,
there is like, as we're talking about, I just don't want to end it so bleak. So like killers, their tactics and stuff are getting better, but also like
technology.
And I think FBI and local PD, they're all learning that like, yeah, the ego does F everything up. We have to work together. Right.
Oh yeah.
And so like databases.
I mean, we're seeing that now with familial DNA, right? The Golden State Killer being caught. I mean, the Vicelia Ransacker, the Golden State Killer, it was very possible that it would be another Zodiac situation where it's like, we're going to have to live for the rest of our lives not knowing who this person is. But now investigators like Paul Holes are outsmarting the system. And now the DNA pool has gone from who's in the system in CODIS to who's put in their DNA to figure out where they're from.
Yeah.
We can capitalize on this, right? So there's always going to be advancements and there's always going to be fluctuations in caught killers versus not caught killers, right?
Yeah.
But you have to keep in mind that the ultimate killer is already thinking of this and already figuring out how to combat those fluctuations, how to combat future stuff that could pop up. I mean, we're talking like very high IQ, intelligent and predictive people who, when your only reason or your only like reason for living is to hunt or to kill, like you study your prey, right? And you dominate them. So
terrifying.
It is. So always keep that in mind too, where it's like, yes, we are making advancements. We are going to like catch more. We are going to be better, but it's always going to be a fight.
Yeah.
Always. So unless we were in a, you know, CCTV kind of situation where you're constantly being watched and all that. We're not getting into all that because it's America. So we're not even going to touch on it, but you know what I mean? Like unless everyone were watched,
mass surveilled.
Yeah.
Well, dude, that is Israel Keyes
in a nutshell,
which is weird. Very... So many other killers get so much shine and like, you know, their names, they're like household names, which is like a perverted and morbid thing to think. Mm-hmm. But Israel's like not well known unless you're in the world of true crime.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm so curious as to why it's recent. Like, born during the time where it has the power to become viral quickly and reach high temperatures of virality, but I don't know.
I think that's coming. I think that's coming down the pike. I'm sure there's going to be a ton of documentaries about it. And like,
me too.
You know, yeah. There's going to be a ton more on Israel in the upcoming years. But I also do believe that at the time, it was probably a part of the deal, you know, with between the prosecution and the FBI to keep Israel's wishes a little bit, to kind of keep the media down as much as possible about it.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Wild. Dude, you did it again.
Beautifully dense.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I love it.
And beautifully packaged. Thank you so much, Heather, for all of that work.
For real. Thanks for coming on. Dude. And being patient and teaching us about Israel and like just predators in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, thank you guys. And by no means am I like, I feel like a sham a little bit because I have like no freaking grounds to be talking about like, you know, Like, in no way am I an expert. It's just, I'm super, as you can tell, passionate about this topic. So I appreciate you guys giving me a platform to come and like share my ideas and share something that like genuinely makes me happy, which is talking about having an open discussion about these things and sharing ideas. You know, I love that. So thank you so much, you guys, for you guys were patient with me. I don't know what you're talking about, me being patient with
no,
you.
No, it was
you're
great. Patient with me in that setup,
so. Our credentials for, I don't know, soliciting advice or like giving our two cents.
Zero.
Zero. Yeah, only apply to us. And we said at the very beginning when we started this podcast, like, we really just have fun, you know, doing this, thinking about these things, studying these things on our own, sharing it with our friends. If anyone else wants to tag along, they're more than welcome. Take it or leave it.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah.
Cool. All right. Let's wrap it up. Heather, thank you so much. Boys, I love you. Listeners out there, thank you for listening and being a part of us. We appreciate all of you out there. And hopefully, you know, you took away something from this episode that might protect you or you can share with someone around you. But with that, bye, lovey, be safe.
Trust your gut, watch your back.
Be careful out there.
Look out for others.
Let's go.
Thanks, sis. I love you. I'll call you after this. Love you.
Thanks, all right. Heather. Sounds good. Thanks,
see
guys.
See everyone.
Thank you. Love you.
Hey, thank you so much for tuning into this episode of 3AM. If you want to support us, visit our Patreon, where patrons have access to exclusive content. If you're not able to support us monetarily, don't worry. This episode is on us. You can still rate and review us on whatever platform you listen to us on. It really does go a long way. You can also follow us on social media. Our handle everywhere, including Patreon, is the 3AM Pod. Finally, do you have any scary stories? If so, submit them to our website, the3ampodcast.com. We love any audio or visual aids that can help bring your stories to life, so file uploads are welcome with your written submissions. We're anxious and excited to hear from you.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes. I've traced heroic acts of bravery. And I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.